From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, scientists discover a new solar system with Earth-like planets. Also today, Cambridge writer Cassie Underwood's new memoir about her efforts to get women to share the stories of their abortions.
We've had people come up to us who say, I have been pro-life my entire life, and I will never think of abortion in the same way again. And we really strip it of all political context and just come at it from a place of love.
Plus, artist Anna Deavere Smith wins a prestigious journalism award for her theater performances, encouraging audiences to discuss big issues.
I'm trying to think of ways that a theater or, you know, concert halls, museums can be places where civic work can really be done. Where can we activate our imagination about our democracy?
That's Radio Boston after this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. For the first time, astronomers have discovered a new solar system with a cluster of seven Earth-like planets orbiting a single star. Earlier today, Sarah Seeger, professor of planetary science and physics at MIT, spoke at a NASA press briefing.
With this discovery, we've made a giant accelerated leap forward in the search for habitable worlds and life on other worlds.
Joining me to talk about the significance of this is Kelly Beattie, a senior editor at Sky and Telescope. And although based in Cambridge, he is joining us from Washington, D.C. Kelly, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Deb.
So why is this discovery important?
Wow, there's a long list. I mean, you know, planets around other stars is nothing new, even multiple planets. We know of stars with four, five, six planets around them. Now, the thing is, often those stars are quite variable in their intensity. You know, it's not a pleasant place to be, and the planets themselves can be really large and gassy and like the size of Jupiter, and we really are not that invested in them in terms of finding something that's like Earth. There are a couple of things special about this system. First of all, there are seven planets, all of which are about the size of Earth or Venus. That's a plus right there. And because they're in tight orbits, they kind of nudge each other in gravitational waves that are diagnostic. And we can tell that they're probably all rocky as well. So that's like two big checks in the Earth-like planet box. And finally, at least three of these planets, and maybe as many as six of them, are in a zone of temperature around their star where water, if it's there, could be in liquid form. And of course, that's a biggie in terms of thinking of the possibility of life on these places.
Right, that's always the question. So right now, it looks like water might be there, but that would require further testing?
Yeah, so we don't know anything about the composition of these planets, whether there's water there, whether there's atmospheres there. That's just, you know, they've just recently been discovered. It's important to note that this particular star, which is known as TRAPPIST-1, was already known to have two or three planets around it last year. And so the team that made that discovery followed up with NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope, an orbiting observatory, and it was able to make incredibly detailed observations. And the way these planets were discovered is they pass in front of the star and momentarily cause that star to dim. So we know how big the planets are, we know what their orbits are, and because we know how hot the star is, we can calculate what the temperatures on the surfaces are.
So they're described as Earth-like, but all you really know is that they're rocky. Is that enough to call them Earth-like?
And they're the size of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And the important thing here, Deb, is that, you know, up until this point, we've been looking for planets a lot around stars like the Sun, because that's what we know and love, right? But it turns out that this type of star, which is called a dwarf, an M dwarf, it's maybe not really much bigger than the size of Jupiter. It's far, far dimmer, not nearly as hot, only a few thousand degrees instead of 10,000 degrees. And if you run the simulations, the kinds of planets that form around dwarf stars are more likely to be small and rocky, not giant Jupiters. And so there's been a kind of shift in the thinking of astronomers looking for these planets, that maybe we ought to be looking around these dwarf stars more, and in fact, it's paid off tremendously. Hmm. One other thing is that this particular star is only 39 light years away, and that makes it relatively close, so that some future technology, like the James Webb Space Telescope, which is due to be launched next year, can potentially pick off the individual planets in this system and study them one at a time.
And what would be some of the main things you would like to learn from studying this new system?
All right, so a real biggie would be, do they have atmospheres? This system is clustered so tightly around its star. All these planets orbit so close that a year on them is anywhere from a day and a half to 12 days. So like the planets go around in at most 12 days around this star. And because of that, they're probably locked in much of the same way that the moon is locked in its orbit around the Earth, so that one side of them faces the star all the time. That means that one side's going to be hot and the other's going to be cold all the time, unless there's an atmosphere. If there's an atmosphere, that gives us the potential to kind of, you know, even out the temperature around the planet and maybe make it more tolerable overall.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Wow, I think that people are really excited about this because, you know, we have been... This is really kind of the holy grail for exoplanet searches, finding a system of planets that are like our own. And the fact that we have found one and it's so close by and there's nothing special about it opens the door for the possibility that there are thousands, maybe millions, right, within reach of our telescopes.
Right. That's what I was thinking, that perhaps, you know, what you're hoping here is that you may have found a way to perhaps locate other similar systems, and they may be more common than you thought at first, right?
Absolutely. These M dwarfs are by far the most common type of star in our solar system. I mean, our sun is technically a dwarf star, but these are much, much smaller and much more common.
So
this is the place to go panning for gold, if you will, when it comes to exoplanet science right now.
So how long would it take before you might get some conclusions, do you think, from looking at this very close by new system?
Yeah, you know, the technology is evolving. As I said, the James Webb Space Telescope will be very useful once it's launched. It's looking mostly at infrared wavelengths, heat wavelengths, and that will be very useful in terms of trying to determine whether these have atmospheres or not. And from there, we might try to understand what the composition is. We can do that from afar. We can tell what kinds of rocks, we can tell what kinds of gases, and we can definitely tell whether there's water or not. So these are the kind of the next steps. I think the notion of, like, is there life on these planets is really a long ways in the future.
All right. Kelly Beattie, senior editor at Cambridge-based Sky and Telescope magazine, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Deb. Thank you so much.
Despite efforts to stem the tide of opioid overdose deaths in Massachusetts, the latest statistics suggest that a record number, some 2,000 people, died of overdoses in this state last year. One of the grassroots groups working to make a dent in this is called Magnolia New Beginnings. It was formed by parents on the North Shore a few years ago, not only to offer support to other parents, but also to help financially by providing scholarships for long-term substance use treatment, which typically is not covered by health insurance. Maureen Kavanaugh founded the group amid her daughter's struggles with substance use. She says she didn't know where to turn after heroin took over her daughter's and then her life. Kavanaugh still bristles at the hurt, the shame, and the isolation she felt when she read a local newspaper headline about her daughter saying, "Former honor student facing prostitution charges." We met with her at her home recently to talk about the purpose of her group.
I started this group so that initially to be able to help people financially who needed a new beginning. But it's evolved into much more than that. It's evolved into a whole support system for not only people that are seeking recovery in trying to navigate the system, but in families and parents to find support to have that feeling that they're not alone. These are all things that I didn't have when I initially found out that my daughter was using. I had no idea where to turn. I didn't know anybody else that had this problem. I felt like I was the only one that had this problem. Thank God I went to a Learn to Cope meeting, because that, I always tell people to go to Learn to Cope. It's the best out there for an in-person meeting. But it's not always enough, because you sometimes need something at 2 o'clock in the morning. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had on my Facebook pages at 2 o'clock in the morning with people that, because I can't sleep and they can't sleep, and, you know, and it's good to know that there's somebody else out there that's feeling like you're feeling.
But also the raising money part is big for you, right? And that's a big part of what you do.
We try really hard to raise as much money as possible, because it's $500 is very often, $500 or $600 is a month's worth of sober living, and that's usually that sometimes is the difference between somebody's life and death, whether they're going to go through 30 days or 60 days or 90 days of treatment and be feeling like they're ready to change their life. And to have to go to a shelter that's not conducive to recovery. So as much money as we raise, we can spend that 10 times over, because there's so many people that need help.
Did you feel that you sort of had to do this to step in, because there was a void? And I mean, why do it this way? Why raise money for that 1 month? Why did you think that was important?
Well, there's so many voids in this system, because, you know, the continuum of care, I think, is the biggest place we fall down. So it's my belief that people that are in recovery need to have a year of supported living in some way or another. So you go through detox, you go through treatment. Hopefully the treatment is longer than 30 days, but it needs to be at least 30 days. And then you go into a supported, good, strong, supported living environment where you're surrounded by people in recovery that are, and you're keeping each other in check. And you're going through the whole first year of your recovery and all the things that happen to a person in life, that a death, a job, getting a job, losing a job, a birthday, fights with your family, breaking up with somebody. All these things happen in a supportive environment. And then people have a better chance of dealing with these things when they're not living in those situations. Because for most people, they've been using drugs in order to deal with any of those things. So if for years that was your go-to, if when you lost a job, you got high. When you whatever it was that you were dealing with in life, even the good things, you celebrated by getting high. How are you supposed to deal with life if you don't have any experience dealing with life? So if you can have a year of that support, you have a much greater likelihood of holding on to your sobriety in a permanent way. And that's what we want.
Yeah. But you have to do it. A private citizen has to start a nonprofit to do it. The system isn't doing it.
No, and that needs to change. Because even if you don't have your heart in this, even if it hasn't affected you personally, which fewer and fewer people can say, you know, for whatever your beliefs are, it's not cost effective to keep sending people out after a few days of detox or a short term in treatment, and then having them come back over and over and over again, at best, or to die. This constant in and out of treatment is very expensive. If we do it right, it's actually turns out to be less expensive, and we're putting healthier people back into society, and that makes sense all around.
But some people might say, you know, people are in and out because they're not ready, right? And maybe it's the person and the illness and not so much the system. What would you say to that?
I think then we need to find better ways to treat our people. I think we need to treat this like any other disease, and because it is a disease, and to make sure that we have the best treatment available to people the first time that they go in. And it's a relapsing brain disease, so we have to also account for that some people may come in and out, because that's the nature of this disease.
Now, your group has 14,000
people on Facebook. Is that right?
Approximately, yeah. And you have about, probably a little more, actually.
And about 700 members in Massachusetts.
We have 700 members, a little over 700 members in our closed Facebook group in Massachusetts. We have a grief support group that has, about 250 people in Massachusetts.
So what would you say is the main purpose of that? I know you talked about people not being alone and not feeling like they were alone, but is it also sort of an information and resource sharing tool for people as well, or do you not call it that?
No, absolutely. I mean, and it's peer support. So there's no one in there that is going to swoop in and fix everything, but there's unbelievable amounts of information. We have files in all of our groups because we have 23 different states we're in. So we have files in all of our groups that are state specific. So they'll have information on what to do in your state. For example, in Massachusetts, if somebody's interested in learning more about Section 35, which is the civil commitment for somebody who's a danger to themselves or others, there's all kinds of paperwork on that. There's a phone number from Mass Bar Association for volunteers that will walk you through the process. There's just information that you wouldn't be able to, it would take forever. It took us forever to find out these things. And this is like a cut to the chase. So here you are, you come into this group, and there is somebody in that group that's been through whatever you're going through, I can guarantee it.
Do you think that it also has any kind of a role in terms of maybe oversight treatment facilities and saying, this one isn't so great, be careful here, or do anything? Does it do that?
Oh, it absolutely does that. You don't want to make a mom mad, I can tell you that. And there's, somebody's not doing the right thing. You don't want to make 725 angry Massachusetts moms. So, I mean, my hope is that when there's a facility or if there's a program not doing the right thing, that we can work with them and make them better. Because it's only to our benefit to have really good services in Massachusetts. And we are so fortunate because I see what goes on in other states, and we really are way ahead of the game as far as good services, but there's plenty of work to be done.
Now, you said you started this because you learned things the hard way going through it with your own daughter, and mm-hmm. you thought you'd provide maybe help to people who need it. How's your daughter now? How old is she? And what, you know, how's her journey been?
She's 24 now, and she's doing really well. I'm very proud of her. She's fighting really hard every day, you know, but this is going to be a lifelong thing. So, and she has days where she struggles, but she's doing really well right now.
And what does she think about all of this that you're doing, that this has taken off and become a job, I would assume, right? A job on top of a full-time job?
She's really proud of me. Mm-hmm. I think she's really proud of everything we're all doing. And her hope is once she has a year that she'll, you know, join me and that she wants to, she talks about making a career out of working in treatment herself. She's pretty inspirational. She's been through a lot.
That's Maureen Cavanaugh, founder and president of Magnolia New Beginnings Incorporated. For more information and links to hers and other substance use disorder groups, go to our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, writer Cassie Underwood talks about her journey to understand her complicated emotions after an abortion. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The complicated emotions surrounding an abortion are not something most people want to talk about, especially someone who's decided to have an abortion. Yet writer Cassie Underwood went from talking about her abortion to just about anyone she met, to writing about it in the New York Times, to then writing a book about her experiences and her efforts to try to get women to share their abortion stories. Underwood's book is titled May Cause Love, An Unexpected Journey of Enlightenment After Abortion. In it, she writes, quote, I remember brushing my teeth the night before my procedure, thinking about the embryo gaining momentum inside of me, wishing there was a woman I could talk to. I didn't find her, so I had to become her. Now, Cassie Underwood is that woman, writing about her experiences and giving lectures on the spirituality of abortion. She's a student at Harvard's Divinity School, and she lives in Cambridge. Cassie, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, as you write in your book, your abortion was in 2004. You were 19 years old, college student in Vermont, and, you know, you decided neither you nor the man you were involved with were ready to be parents. Describe the decision-making there and why that was so instrumental in your life.
Well, in some ways, it was a gut feeling as soon as the doctor told me that I was pregnant in the University Health Clinic at UVM. And in other ways, I had to gather all the information that would make that a more sure decision for me. I was raised in Kentucky, so I didn't hear anything about abortion growing up except on billboards, anti-abortion billboards, and from students at school who had anti-abortion messages they were bringing in from church. And so I grew up with a judgment about abortion. I thought that it was wrong for me.
Right. But you did it anyway. And then how did you feel?
Afterward?
Right.
Immediately afterward, I actually felt I felt a lot of different emotions. I felt like I wanted to talk about the fact that I'd been pregnant. I felt that like I wanted to meet more people who'd experienced this, and I felt I didn't feel I just felt the sadness had a lot to do with not being able to talk to anybody, and that this had happened without knowing anyone in advance that could help me.
Right, but you went on this journey, this unbelievable journey, to try to reconcile your emotions. Describe why you felt like you needed to do that.
When I was about 3 years after my abortion, I heard from my ex-boyfriend that he was having a baby with someone else, and they had decided to name the baby the same name as I had tossed out to him for the few minutes that I considered keeping the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And that was really shocking to me, and it was a violation of my identity as this extremely pro-choice. I was super pro-choice, and now I had all these feelings, and that didn't fit into the political narrative about relief.
Right. So that was what did it. That was really what kind of struck it, was finding out that he was having another baby. He was able to move on, not only move on, but maybe name this baby the same thing that you were going to name it. And then that triggered something in you.
That and the fact that he was not able to raise the child. He and the mother were not able to raise the child. And so that brought up emotions that there was this child out there, and that I was having these emotions about not having a baby. Mm. So that was painful. And feeling like I couldn't talk to anybody about it authentically, what I was feeling.
Right. Now describe that a little bit, because I think that is a big part of what you write about. You say that the abortion issue has become so politicized, right, that it's difficult to find comfort or acceptance. You feel that maybe admitting, and you can tell me if I'm wrong here, admitting that you're having difficulty after an abortion is almost taking a side, right? So what do you know, how did you deal with that, and how did you find comfort?
Well, I really didn't know who to tell who would not think that I was saying that I was shaming people for having an abortion if I were to say that I was sad afterward. That can be taken as shaming, or that other people are supposed to feel that way, which of course isn't true. People feel all sorts of different ways. And so I had to go through a lot of pain to get to the point that I was willing to face this. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was living in New York City, and I just decided I needed a big journey. I needed to try everything that was available to me to heal and to find new language to talk about this.
When you talk about the pain that you went through, I know in your book you write about alcohol problems. You were arrested, right? You had. Did you ever say that those problems were because of this unresolved emotions that I have over here, or no?
Well, I had alcohol. I mean, I'm sober, and I had symptoms of alcoholism and drinking problems way before I got pregnant. I would say that having the abortion accelerated a pre-existing issue, because, you know, I had nowhere to talk about this. I had no context for what I was going through. But I would never say that abortion was why why I got arrested.
No, yeah. Not why you got arrested, but yeah. Maybe you were not dealing with your emotions and you didn't have a venue to deal with your emotions, so it exacerbated your problems. Is that right? And so that was the pain that you were talking about that led you on a journey to try to deal with those emotions so, you know, it wouldn't cause further problems in your life.
Exactly.
Right?
And because I believe that there was something I had to learn from this. I mean, I believe that there was a possibility for self-discovery and transcendence and, you know, just a spiritual experience through this.
Now, you talk about this experience of exploring all different kinds of rituals, Buddhist rituals, mm-hmm. Japanese rituals, going to Catholic retreats and different things like that to try to understand your decision better and your emotions better around this. Describe some of those for our listeners.
Well, the Buddhist ritual is called Mizuko Kuyo, and it came from Japan. And in Japan, there's not a big debate about abortion. The ritual started hundreds of years ago. Women started it. And for me, being able to acknowledge my abortion in the setting in a Buddhist church without there being an implication that I had made the wrong decision was really important to me. And at the end of the ritual, the Buddhist priest said that the Mizuko would be my guide on the path to enlightenment. And I thought that was a meaningful thought as I continued.
Hmm. And what else? What else would you advise people as they are looking for some sort of spiritual comfort after going through this, based on the fact that you went through several of them? What do you say to people? Should they, you know, do you make any recommendations or give them any advice?
I think that everyone should follow what feels true to them. I had to map out everything that I could possibly find because I didn't want to just try one thing and then find out that it didn't work and not have anything else lined up. I wanted to feel better. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that everyone should just follow what feels true. If they are gravitating toward Buddhism or Judaism or Catholicism or something secular, therapy, start with what works for them.
Mm-hmm. Which ritual would you say was most surprising?
The most surprising one, I think that was actually the Catholic retreat.
Really? Why?
This is going to sound silly or naive, but they're not all of them are like this. They're all independent. These retreats, I went to Rachel's Vineyard. But the one I went to, it felt judgmental, and I didn't think that I was going to find that there. I actually thought that it was going to be, there would be no judgment there. So I was surprised that there would be judgments of abortion and a retreat about healing after abortion.
Mm. And why did you feel that? Is there a specific thing that happened that you recall?
There was just some language around the evils of abortion. And there was a lot of language around evil and abortion.
So what do you think it was that helped you to finally come to terms with it? Was it time in a lot of ways? Was it this, you know, was it a combination of all of this searching or what was it?
Yeah, I don't think it was time. I think it was real. Each ritual I did built on the last, and they each gave me a tool that I could take away. And at the bottom of everything, it seemed to be the need to grieve, which I would have been very defensive about if someone had told me that in the beginning of the journey. But the practice of grief, sitting down every day and grieving, these are tools that I'm taking that I've taken into my life since I completed the journey that I write about in the book. But the grieving really helped me, and finding a community has really helped me, of people who've experienced abortion.
And so what about your views on abortion now? Where do you stand? The same?
People have been having abortions for thousands of years. They're on record since 2700 BCE. They happen whether abortion is legal or illegal. And so to me, women have died when it wasn't legal. So I think that people should be able to live and should be able to be trusted to know their own situations and their own lives.
And then what about the folks who say it shouldn't be allowed at all?
What about them?
What would you say to them?
I would say that it would be helpful to maybe to listen to someone who has experienced abortion, and if they too, because some people have experienced abortion and they don't think it should be legal, and that I hope that they will find community and with other people who've experienced abortion regardless of their political beliefs.
Now, this happened to you 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think things have changed?
Politically?
All? Hmm.
Not at all. No. Mm-hmm. It's the same. It's really the same debate going on. It's just at this point, just little. I think that the abortion war, there will be no winner. There are no winners in the abortion war. And it's really time to change the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there are no signs of that happening anytime soon. Right. I mean, do you think that your work might help do that eventually, or having people talk about it? I mean, what are your thoughts about that?
I hope that people who have experienced abortion will come together. Because right now there is a separation of people who've experienced abortion into pro-life and pro-choice camps. Mm-hmm. And then there's a ton of people who have no place because their stories don't fit into those narratives. And what I hope is that we'll all come together, those who have experienced abortion, and really start to support each other and heal together. Not necessarily even from abortion. Not all people need to heal from abortion or after abortion, but to heal the cultural pain that we've all been feeling around this.
You're now at Harvard's Divinity School. Mm-hmm. What led you to Divinity School?
It was really my journey and that I write about in the book. My life changed from doing all the rituals that I write about and all that exploration. And by the time I reached the end, I knew that I wanted to serve people who've experienced abortion in a bigger way, and also that I only had my personal experience as a white, cisgendered female from Kentucky, raised Episcopalian. That was my background, and I wanted to understand the cultural and historical context for other people's lives and listen to more people and understand different viewpoints.
And what's the reaction that you get, for the most part, when you talk about it now? Now that you've been able to maybe have a little bit of distance yourself and process a little bit, when you talk with women now, is it any different, or what would you say is the overall reaction that you get from folks when you're talking about abortions?
It's a real range, but the more authentically I speak about it, the more people open up to me about their lives, and the more they're going to open up to me about having experienced abortion, and the more truth we can all come to, and the more reality we can all come to. Mm. So it's been really a beautiful, positive experience for me.
Yeah, you wrote about it in the New York Times,
yes,
in the Modern Love column, and you've been very public about something that some people never mm-hmm. talk about. So is this the big thing that you want to change?
Abortion?
No, the discussion around it.
The discussion around it. Yeah, I think that what I really want is for people to feel like they can share authentically.
All right. Well, Carrie Underwood is a Cambridge-based writer. She's written about abortion for the New York Times Modern Love column, and her new memoir is titled May Cause Love, An Unexpected Journey of Enlightenment After Abortion. There's more information about the book at our website, radioboston.org. Cassie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Anna Deavere Smith's plays have been called a new form of theater, usually one-woman shows where she portrays several different characters reflecting on a social justice issue. She's also well-known for her roles on The West Wing, and she received the 2013 National Humanities Medal from President Obama, all of which makes Deavere Smith an unusual choice for the George Polk Career Award, one of the highest honors in journalism. The curator of the Polk Awards says Deavere Smith was not a traditional choice, but after debate, the group agreed that she is a reporter in how she goes about researching her topics. That research is evident in Deavere Smith's latest work titled Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education. The play focuses on education and its links to mass incarceration. We spoke with Deavere Smith last August when she was in Cambridge to perform Notes from the Field at the ART.
I really feel that we should do more than just talk about how artistic institutions can be places for sharing ideas and even going further these days, talking about development of moral imagination and empathy and stuff like that. So I'm trying to think of ways that theater or other kinds of, you know, concert halls, museums can be places where civic work can really be done. Where can we activate our imagination about our democracy? Is it just that we can only do it sitting on our couch? But when do we as a public get to talk, most importantly, with strangers? And I know there's some places like churches or guilds where these things happen, but even in that case, you know, you're more likely to be with somebody who shares a belief that you do. But I think one of the things that this particular election is showing us is we can't assume anything about beliefs in the United States of America. So we need to know more about one another. And that's with the theater. There's people, strangers in the audience. And so we're training people to host small group conversations. And what would normally be the second act, I'm given over to that enterprise. And the people are going to go off in small groups and talk about this matter of what's happened to our public school system and why it seems to be, for some kids, a kind of inroad to a life of incarceration. How do we stop what people call, some people call the school-to-prison pipeline, some people call it, which I don't think is really fair to blame teachers in schools. Some people call it the cradle-to-prison pipeline. Some people call it the womb-to-prison pipeline.
You know, some of these issues were really thrust into the national spotlight 2 years ago in Ferguson.
Okay. Ferguson is what really, really, really opened it up.
Right. Is this a new civil rights movement that we're witnessing right now? And is this what you want the theater to be part of?
Well, I would like to. I'm not sure if we're there yet. You know, a person who speaks about this matter much better than I, much more eloquently, is Sherilyn Ifill, who is the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And she would say that we are probably in the midst of coming towards a civil rights movement, but she urges us not to simply make that about the criminal justice system, about mass incarceration. She doesn't think that we can really talk about that without talking about education. And what she points out is that's because this country is a country that makes big, big investments. We call it policy, but they're big investments. She says, you know, imagine there was a decision to invest in suburbs. So what happened? They made a whole interstate highway system to have that, right?
Right.
You know what I mean? The building of a middle class. She points out that black people were left out of these, you know, opportunities. But so we can do this. We can do this. And we made an investment in public schools, particularly in the late 40s and the 50s, Brown versus Board of Ed. But as we know, the South rebelled from that. And rather than doing what desegregation was meant to do, they made other private schools for their kids. So we look 6 years later and we kind of go, well, what happened?
So we need a new one. But we also had a black president for 8 years. What happened?
Martin Luther King, I wish I knew it by heart. I would love to be able to say it for you. It's actually one of the most extraordinary passages in Letter from a Birmingham Jail, where he talks about the need to show tension, that he's not afraid of tension, that it needs to be revealed. And the metaphor that he gives is like a sore that is full of pus or infection. It has to be opened to light and air to heal. And so I think that our president, who is really, in a way, as a black person, I'm proud to identify him as black, but he's much more complicated than that in terms of what's underneath that black skin, as we know. White mother, raised by white people, father from Kenya, grew up all over the world, learned all about, you know, empathy and compassion as a young man. I like to think of him as something I heard Axelrod call him, as this splendid man. I think of President Obama as a splendid human being. And so it's almost like we needed this splendid human being who had already been a global citizen as a young boy. We needed this splendid person so that we, you know, it's what all our pus came forward in his presence. So people say, oh, it was post-racial. He was post-racial. The country was not. I mean, I've been so busy teaching very well-off, very talented people for 40 years. My mother was a school teacher. I grew up in de facto segregation. All my aunts were school teachers. All my mother's friends were school teachers. I watched them change lives. 2011, somebody gives me the opportunity to look at just how bad public school is. And I where have I been?
But at the same time, you don't want to blame teachers necessarily. When you say that, Are you talking really about school, or are you talking about the bigger cultural problems that are reflected in our schools, or both?
Well, yeah, you say it better than I could say it. Yeah, that's why we shouldn't blame teachers, because we're talking about a few generations of poverty and trauma. We're talking about a post-crack cocaine epidemic and new drug epidemics. We're talking about an over-medicated society anyway. There weren't guns in neighborhoods when I was a girl growing up in Baltimore. So to blame a teacher when we don't even take care of them, for part of my research, I went to Finland, and teachers are revered. They don't send special ed kids off and away. They're integrated in the classroom. They're not looked at like a pathological or a medical problem, looking like a pedagogical challenge. Teachers continue their research. I mean, that sounds like a really cool job to me. If you get to be coming to work every day as though you're not just delivering test scores, but you're really evolving and getting more support and the opportunity to ask more questions about the classroom, and in a place like Finland, as elsewhere in Europe, at a moment where these otherwise homogenous societies are changing a great deal because of migrations.
Right. I don't want to, you know, seem as if I'm Debbie Downer here, but what I'd like to ask you is, you know, where is theater right now in terms of the public conversation, and what obstacles does it face? Is it looked at almost as more of an elite kind of organization, and is it going to be difficult?
Yes, that is the case. But I have to, I have to expose my humility here. Then you get a hit like Hamilton, like a remarkable event that everybody would like to go to. They can't get in, no matter how much money they want to spend. And the first time I saw it, I thought, every kid in America needs to see this play, because it shows you that revolution, you know, it requires reading and writing and planning and talking and courage. And so I think we talk about this whole thing, you know, too generally. We would never talk about medicine that way, or money. It's kind of like the question over and over again from very smart people is, how can art make a difference? Can art make a difference? How can art make a difference? Can art, that, I don't even think that's the question anymore. I can't fill a stadium, but Jay-Z can. And, you know, we have to start where are. Wouldn't it be nice if all the sort of middle-class people, predominantly white, who come to my show, what if we said, you know, we'll give you a break if you bring somebody to the theater with you who's nothing like you. Can you find a kid? Bring a kid. Somebody that you work with, who you've never talked to, who's a different race, a different religion, bring them to the theater with you. I mean, we could do something about this other than continue to complain about the fact that it's all old white people.
And by
the way, I'm happy if any kind of color and any kind of age buys a ticket to my work, I have to say. You know, grateful.
Yeah. For people who don't know, we should say that you know, do dozens of characters usually during a performance. It's amazing to me to watch you, if I can say this, you become another person without any sort of outside aid. It's just your body, it's your voice. So I can imagine that must take an enormous amount
of work, and just, you know, it's the work of me learning the material, but it's also the work of us learning the communities. And part of, in a way, it's my favorite part. In a way, it's me, I think, too, you know, solving a sort of crisis of having grown up in a de facto segregation. And it isn't just that, you know, well, don't go there, you can't come here, stop, no, not permitted. It's also as a sort of psychological survival mechanism. Many of us had to grow up thinking, well, don't even worry about those people over there. You know, what happens to you as a human? And so this project called Everything's Under This Umbrella, on the Road of Search for American Character, which I started in the late 70s, It has helped me. My goal is to become America word for word. That's the kind of thing you think when you're 28. But it has helped me feel less strange. Mary Ellen Mark, the great, great American photographer, the late Mary Ellen Mark, writes in the preface to her book, American Odyssey, that the camera gave her the necessary distance to get close to strangers. And so I feel similarly that the tape recorder, imagine you do too, has given me the necessary distance that I need to get close to those people who are not like me at all. And that's really been my quest. I don't like feeling like I have to be in a tribe in order to feel psychologically safe and full and thorough and with an identity. I don't like that situation. And it's worse in the world now than it's ever been. People like to use words like empathy, compassion, moral imagination. And, you know, talk about the opposite of Debbie Downer. I guess you have to be Ursula Upper to even go there, Ursula Upper, up with people.
I like it.
but now, 4 years later, and watching what we've been watching in this country lately, I'm like, we got to get behind this. We got to get behind what would be called the soft stuff. Because laws can only take us so far. You know, desegregation. So what does the South do? As Sherrilyn Ifill says, you know, they closed the schools in Virginia for 5 years rather than in Prince Edward County. Closed the schools for 5 years rather than integrate. And what concerns me is 60 years later, we just don't like each other. College campuses, you know, kids want to be in their tribes. You know, they have a problem just in terms of how student life tends to be. It doesn't matter what you teach in the classroom, of delivering to the world people who are willing to live together, be together, and should I use that other very dangerous word, love each other?
I wanted to ask you about what, go back to schools for a moment, because one thing that we've also seen in education is the presence of police officers in school. I believe at last check, there are about 19,000 police officers stationed in schools across the country. Many folks say it's a different time now. We need those police officers. We've had lots of school shootings. We've learned over the decades that school can be a dangerous place, and those police officers keep the order. But I imagine that they could also contribute to the problem that you're drawing attention to in this piece. So what do you say to those folks?
Well, I've certainly been in environments where they are. You know, and I've heard both sides. You know, I've heard the people who say these kids are very disrespectful. They say, you know, well, guess we're going to have to call your mother. Call my mom. I mean, you and me, kid, I can't imagine nobody ever had to call my mother. Call my mom, right? And again, that's coming from someplace that is not about that, just about that school. That's coming from a lot of things that we can generalize about, you know, single moms, this, that. I'm not going to generalize because everything is very particular, that a child comes to school without the self-regulation that is required. And then we can critique schools and say you shouldn't need so much self-regulation to learn and find the joy of learning and all that stuff. I think it's really, really unfortunate that we get to that place, that we are at that place, that they are there, that children have to go through metal detectors. You know, the fact that these children have to go to school, go through gates, go through, you know, or buildings that you can't even figure out how you get in. You know, every door is shut. What does that mean? And of course, yeah, sure, that's the, he's right there with handcuffs. What, you know, we don't have to imagine what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm.
Can you leave us with a little bit of a character telling people what you think this is all about? Who would you choose?
I don't know. Everybody's so, well, interdependent. I'll leave you with a person who's now dead, who died at 98, who I think has some real wisdom. She was a great philosopher of education. Yet I found her so full of compassion and love for children, and her name is Maxine Green, and I think she gives us a historical context of why we are, in a way, where we are with schools in general. Maxine Green, and this is called Factories. But the institution itself is modeled after the factory when it started. And I always tell people when they put clocks in classrooms and try to impose like clock time on children who grew up on farms, or for example, to put the principal in an office, it makes you frightened to go. Or even when I go to a school and I stand at the clerks,
and very nervous if they're busy. I don't know if I should say anything. And I know that they're liberating principals like Debbie, who has a group of five kids every morning and a teacher. And they talk, she's like, how can you have a school where you don't know that somebody died the night before? But it's all modeled after a factory with a boss and there are workers. It's linked to the acceptance of hierarchies. I can't stand that. And the only thing I can think, you know, is Thomas Jefferson, who's so admired, had a bill, one of the first bills for public education, and it had like schools. He said, out of the first 3 years, you'd have 10 kids, and out of the next three, you'd have more. But it was for excellence. It was a very meritocratic kind of thing. He said, you know, you choose the worthy ones, and you throw out the rubbish. And the rubbish were the poor kids who couldn't make it. Yeah, after you get the excellent ones who will appreciate our rational legislators. And when you think of the impact that those denials had, this great spokesman who had slaves and wouldn't let them go when he died, incredible. Oh, no. I can show you in his notes on the state of Virginia. You throw out the rubbish.
Can I clap?
Anna Deavere Smith is a writer, performer, and professor. She received the George Polk Career Award, one of the highest honors in journalism. We spoke with her last August. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.